hairstyles, the hairstyles that people like myself, who have our feet firmly in the firmament of electromagnetic observations, deal with on a daily basis. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give this talk, and this whole conference is a little bit outside of my normal experience, and so it's been very educational, and it's been a pleasure to learn a bit about the details of what goes into these exciting new observations that are hopefully on the horizon. So this is my one-slide summary of the kinds of things I've been hearing, and gravitational wave observations promise to be these beautiful, clean physics experiments, and they consist, barring the things we've heard in the past day and a half, of essentially three phases, which people spend varying amounts of time trying to compute waveforms from, things like the in-spiral, which you can treat perturbatively, the very non-linear merger events, which require detailed calculations, and then a ring down, and every now and then there's something exotic like supernovae or mergers of neutron stars, etc. But this reminds me very much of clean babies, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and simple to understand. And as a father of four, I'm more familiar with babies that look like this. And this is not my child. My wife would kill me if I ever let one get this messy. But they're certainly not clean. And the same is true of the physics that I worry about on a daily basis. We know a lot, we think, about compact objects. We have a lot of phenomenology that we can probe and access. And I have a list here, which is not necessarily inclusive, comprehensive, and I certainly won't be detailed for all of these subjects today. But just to run through some of the things we know about black holes, even when they are completely absent of accretion flows or accretion disks, not interacting with anything in their vicinity, they occasionally pass in front of stars and produce microlensing events, which we can use to measure masses and statistics. Many of the accreting black holes we see have these ultra-relativistic jets, which is always fun to talk about with the general public. How does something that's supposed to eat everything in the universe produce some of the fastest and most energetic outflows ever observed? And for these jets, we have observations of the polarization maps, which give us some information about what the magnetic fields are doing, and observations of the variability in some resolved sources, which give us information about how those magnetic fields change in time. We have these relativistically broadened iron lines, which are presumably broadened through the orbital motion around rapidly rotating black holes and the gravitational redshift. I'll talk a bit more on that later. We have a lot of information about the spectral states of these objects and how those, we think, relate to the accretion flow properties, especially for X-ray binaries. We have information in X-ray binaries about their interaction with their companion objects and how the tidal deformations of those objects result in variations in their light curves, and how we might back out information about the binary orbits from that. We have these wonderful QPOs, which, although perhaps enigmatic, certainly have very well-defined signals and probably are telling us something about relativistic gravity, and I'll talk a little bit more on that later. We have the ultimate clocks in the universe, the pulsars, and despite their extreme uniformity, they pulse whether or not you want them to. The subpulse structure varies quite a bit from one to the other, and this presumably tells us about the magnetic field structure in the emission region. Some pulsars are X-ray bursters. They explosively burn accreted material from their binary companion, and sometimes they do it with even larger luminosities, burning the ashes of what they burned. In a couple cases, we've seen these giant flares from magnetars. These are presumably associated with global reconfigurations of the magnetic field and star quakes. And of course, we have the X-ray flashes and gamma ray bursts. And if you've seen one gamma ray burst, you've seen one gamma ray burst. Nevertheless, they all seem to follow some somewhat generic scaling relations, and we have at least a canonical, if not a well-supported model for how these operate. And I think the point here isn't that I wanted you to get much out of any one of those examples, but I hope to have convinced you that there's a rich phenomenology to be mined. So we can think of this as being dirt. But we can also think of this as an opportunity to get a number of handles on compact object physics, and especially general relativity. So what will I talk about today? I'll primarily talk about three things, accretion, jet formation, and variability in accreting systems. And I'm not going to, again, talk about any of them in any great detail, just highlight some interesting and maybe speculative ideas. And these will be things that relate to general relativity. How does general relativity critically affect what we see? And perhaps more interesting to the audience here, how might we use the things we see to learn about general relativity from dirty astrophysics observations? So going back to the beginning, you know, black holes have a long history, but black holes astronomical objects, objects for which we have observations, are relatively new. And here's a paper from 1969 where Donald Lyndon Bell first describes the notion in any detail of supermassive black holes and why they have to be involved in AGN. And he has this nice sentence in this prescient paper, which outlined essentially our understanding of accretion theory, including magnetic transport of angular momentum. But he has this, I think, important statement in this paper that says, we would be wrong to conclude that such relativistic objects in space, space-time, should be unobservable. It is my thesis that we have been observing them indirectly for many years. This is the first time somebody said that a supermassive black hole might be at the center of AGN. And his argument rests on three points: power, variability, and inevitability. And the power, we knew at this point that quasars were extragalactic and they're extraordinarily luminous, and that means you need some way of generating huge amounts of power. And because their optical variability told us that they were small, that means you had to produce a tremendous power density. And the only game in town for that was gravitational binding energy, accretion power. And if you accrete enough material to make the luminosity you see in quasars, inevitably you end up making a black hole. And this story hung together pretty well. In 1982, Soltan made the argument that if quasars were a phase of every AGN, every supermassive black hole, you could reproduce the masses we see today. So it all kind of made sense. But for the historically astute, you might feel like you're hearing a rerun, because this has not been the first time that people have employed accretion power. Here's an example from the mid-19th century, where no less a luminary than Lord Kelvin pointed out that some form of the meteoric theory is certainly the true and complete explanation of solar heat. It can scarcely be doubted. That is to say, the sun shines because it contracts under the action of its own gravity, or it accretes meteors. And in the mid-19th century, this was the going theory, first laid out by Helmholtz, another name we encounter in our freshman physics books, for how the sun is powered. No other natural explanation, except by chemical action, can be conceived, and chemical action can't do it. And there is no difficulty in accounting for 20 million years heat by the meteoric theory, and that was, of course, a success. Now, we know this isn't right today, and even at the time, there were inklings this was wrong. One of the things Darwin did, which doesn't cause trouble south of the border, is help put Charles Lyell's uniformity theory of geology on firm ground, pointing out that the Earth had to be much older than people thought, billions of years, in fact. And here's a paper in Nature just a few years later pointing out that this kind of argument doesn't hold water when you compare it to the current age estimates of the Earth. And one of the great heroes of astrophysics, Cecilia Payne, in the mid-1920s, in her thesis, did the first proper calculation of the ionization balance in stellar atmospheres and found that stars were mostly hydrogen, which made this even more difficult because hydrogen just isn't that massive, the sun isn't that dense. All right. So what happened in the 30s, we all know. Pons Beta came along and pointed out that it was the CNO cycle, it wasn't gravity at all. What was missing from Lord Kelvin's approach was new physics. And we'd hope now that we are in a better position, we know a lot more, and yet we still have these kinds of pictures, which people here at Perimeter must know all about. General relativity tells us that 95% of the universe is not made out of the same stuff as you or I, or the Earth, or all the stars and visible objects we see. It's something totally new and different, and that's exciting. It's also the price of keeping general relativity. So just like geology kind of pointed to the error of gravitational contraction as a means to power the sun, we already know that there's something fishy going on. Either we have to introduce new materials, new particles, new things to the universe, or maybe general relativity doesn't work on large scales, which brings up the question, does general relativity work on the small scales? Are we making the same kind of mistake? So to address this, there are a number of things one might do. And they all essentially are different ways of validating the predictions of general relativity in any way you can. And this whole conference is devoted to one of those, searching for gravitational waves and trying to predict what they ought to look like. But there are other ways to do it. And we can use some of that astrophysical hair, that extra stuff, the interactions with all the plasma around some black holes, to do some of this as well. And so I wanted to describe to you how that kind of goes. So how does accretion to black holes work? It's a very simple diagram. We start off at large distances with some stuff. That stuff falls, and as it falls, it releases gravitational binding energy, and there's some fraction of gm over r times the mass accretion rate. This is the amount of power we have. Okay, the reason why black holes are such good engines is because they're so small. Things get to fall a long, long way. And some fraction of that converted gravitational binding energy, which results primarily in kinetic energy initially, is converted into heat and subsequently radiated. So there's some radiative coefficient here. Once the material reaches the horizon of a black hole, it passes on through, it's lost to the visible universe, whatever kinetic energy it had goes into the mass, and we're finished. So black holes turn out to be relatively simple accretors. Typical numbers for this radiative coefficient for something like the black hole at the center of our galaxy is about 0.1%, maybe 0.001%. For quasars, we think it's around 10%. In general relativity, the maximum is about 33%. And that's because stuff has to be moving as it falls into the black hole. In contrast, accretion onto a star is somewhat different. And by star, I don't necessarily mean something shining. It can be anything where the photosphere is visible from the exterior universe. So this can be neutron stars, it can be boson stars, it can be gravistars, it can be whatever you want, as long as you get to see where the stuff stops. The initial phase is very similar. We have stuff fall on, release gravitational binding energy, thermalize, and emit, and we get a luminosity associated with that in exactly the same form. It turns out this luminosity is actually a little bit less for neutron stars than it is for black holes due to the neutron star quadrupole moment pushing the ISCO out to larger radii. But another thing happens when we talk about stars. The stuff, when it finally stops, deposits the remainder of its energy in heat in the object. And that means that there's surface luminosity that is everything minus what we already emitted. Now, there's stuff we emitted into radiation that we've seen, but there's also anything else. All right? So you can put that into outflows, or you can put that in neutrinos, whatever you want. It's everything minus what we've lost already. That comes out of the surface luminosity. We don't actually have to know what the mass accretion rate is or what the binding energy is. We can reparametrize the surface luminosity in terms of the accretion flow luminosity and these unknown efficiencies, but we do have some physical sense of how big they can be. Remember, they were on the order of 0.1% for something like Sagittarius Star. Now, for reasons that I'm not going to go into today, feel free to ask about later if you want, high redshift surfaces tend to be very good black bodies. They're, in fact, a perverse example of the black body cavity we all teach our introductory physics students. And so if you give me the surface luminosity, which you get from this kind of argument, the apparent radius at infinity, I can then compute the temperature at infinity of the emission. And it's just a black body emitting with that temperature. So remember, a moment ago, I said the accretion flow luminosity of neutron stars is a little bit less, and yet, when you look at the luminosities of neutron stars, they're two orders of magnitude brighter than their black hole counterparts once you've properly normalized everything. And the reason is exactly this thermal component. And you see this thermal bump in the neutron star X-ray spectrum. And so this has been taken. The fact that neutron stars have this bright surface emission and black holes don't has been taken as evidence for horizons in the case of black holes. It's one of the fundamental predictions of general relativity on small scales. That black holes have horizons, that they are disconnected from the rest of the universe. And this is borne out by looking at the astrophysical junk falling onto black holes. Now, if you're not convinced, we can make this a much stronger case by looking at one object in particular, one that I'll return to occasionally throughout the talk, Sagittarius A star. That's, again, the black hole at the center of our galaxy. And the reason why we can do such a better job with Sag A star is that we know a lot more about it. And so here's an example of the spectrum. We have the non-thermal radio spectrum associated with the synchrotron emission from the disk. There's a Maxwellian bump associated with emission at the disk inner edge. I say Maxwellian and not thermal because this has the wrong temperature. The electrons are colder than they ought to be, and this is thought to be associated with the inefficiency for heating electrons in low accretion rate accretion flows. And then we have infrared emission up at high frequencies. But these have no quiescent component. They're highly variable. We only see flaring infrared emission, so we only have upper limits on what the actual luminosity of Sag A star is in the infrared. If we throw a surface around Sagittarius, if we say Sagittarius is not a black hole, but it's some sort of object, and that object is within the photon orbit, the Schwarzschild photon orbit, and we plug in an efficiency of 0.1%, the kind that we think is appropriate for Sagittarius, we should see a spectral component that looks like this. And you'll note that this is 1.5 to 2 orders of magnitude brighter than any of the infrared flux points. So this is excluded right away. We could drive that efficiency up, but if you saw the difference between the kind of accretion flow we think Sagittarius is and a quasar, your eyes are pretty good. On the other hand, we can make the surface very, very large. And as we make the surface large, it can be cooler. We can shift the peak of the emission down to lower frequencies where the limits are less constraining. And we can just barely fit at the few sigma level the observations. But this kind of situation is already excluded by high frequency, very long baseline interferometry measurements of the radio photosphere of Sagittarius. We can make all this more precise by plotting things in this way. On the vertical axis, we have the ratio of the surface luminosity to the observed luminosity. On the horizontal axis, we have the angular size of Sagittarius. And every one of those flux points puts a line on this plot. Above this line, the surface would be too bright. It would be ruled out by that flux measurement. It is the envelope of all of these that is excluded. So everything above that lower bound is too bright. And here you see exactly what I was saying. It gets much more permissive as we go to larger and larger sizes, just because the temperature goes down. However, these millimeter and submillimeter Earth-size arrays of radio telescopes have placed serious or significant constraints upon how big it is, constraining the radio photosphere of Sagittarius to be within about the photon orbit. And that's at the 3 sigma level. And so everything to the right of this red line would be too big. And we're forced to live in this little corner. And I should emphasize that the vertical and horizontal axes are direct observables. I didn't assume general relativity in making this picture. It's not necessary. You do need to assume some very generic things about whatever theory describes gravity, but those are satisfied by every serious contender. And so these are direct observables, and gauge invariant quantities, and it's not dependent on the specifics of GR. Unfortunately, I don't really know what the luminosity of a surface should be. On the other hand, I do have a good handle on what these efficiencies are. And we could recast this vertical axis in terms of these efficiencies. Higher efficiencies means less surface emission because more emission came out before hitting the surface. And these efficiencies I have a good handle on because those are dependent upon laboratory scale densities, temperatures, and magnetic field strengths. And so we think we understand how plasma operates in those situations. And what you find is that you need an efficiency greater than 99.6%. So if material loses 99.6% of its gravitational binding energy on the way down and lands ever so softly on the surface, it is consistent at the 3 sigma level with this limit. And that number is so absurdly large that I think we can say, yes, Sagittarius has a horizon. Now, we're sufficiently creative, maybe we can get around this, but it seems to be quite difficult. So at least one horizon exists in the universe, as far as I'm concerned. Note that necessary to this whole kind of argument was first the astrophysical stuff. We needed to have stuff falling on so that we could look at the consequences of that. And it was also important to use many different observations. We needed the flux distribution at a number of frequencies in order to figure out what the spectrum was and validate our notions of what the accretion flow looks like. We needed the flux observations in the infrared in particular to constrain the luminosity of the surface. And we needed size constraints that came from these millimeter VLBI imaging techniques. All right. So that's accretion in general. There's also accretion in the specific. And there are a number of better models than just stuff falling on. And these have been used to infer something about black hole spin. And so let me give you a one-slide primer on the thin disks and why they're particularly useful. Thin disks are optically thick, which means the luminosity at any point is entirely a local quantity. They are radiatively efficient, which means that they're geometrically thin. The typical kinds of models people talk about are these alpha disk models, or Shakura-Sanyaev models, or if you're a relativist, Novikov-Thorne models. And in these, alpha is just a parametrization of the viscosity, and the viscosity controls the transport of angular momentum. But it is important to note that it does not control the transport of energy. There is viscous energy transport. But the rate of viscous energy transport does not depend upon alpha directly. It depends only upon m dot. And there is energy release from infall, and that doesn't depend upon alpha, only upon m dot. So that means the luminosity is independent of alpha, only m dot. And more importantly, the spectrum is independent of alpha, only m dot. And so that means that we can say some generic things about what these disks look like, even though we don't understand how angular momentum transport really operates in practice. And these spectra generally are this kind of multicolor black body form. So how does one measure spin? Well, the luminosity of these objects depend firstly upon the structure of the accretion disk, which is given by m dot, but it also depends upon the size of the emitting region. That is to say, we could just write down L equals area sigma T to the fourth. And that's a pretty decent approximation of what the luminosity of these objects looks like. Now, what is the area? Well, it's roughly the ISCO radius squared. We have to modify that by an inclination factor. Okay. What temperature should we use? Well, it turns out the color temperature isn't perfect because there's Comptonization. It isn't a perfect black body. But you can calculate what the appropriate coefficient is. So you take the color temperature, which you just abstract from the spectrum, you multiply it by some known factor, and you can take a single source, and you can verify that over a wide variety of temperatures, you get the right accretion, or the right luminosity. Okay, so you can validate this kind of thinking. And so the story here, then, is to measure the temperature from the spectrum, infer the mass and inclination from binary light curves, assume that the inclination of the binary is the same as the inclination of the accretion disk, from that extract the area of the emitting region, and therefore the ISCO radius, and from that get the spin. And this is what people do. Here's a nice picture, a table provided to me, Shane Davis, who's one of the lead proponents of this kind of thing. And here's a number of stellar mass black holes, or X-ray binaries, and these are the various spin estimates with some to be determined in there. And they run the gamut from, zero, tenth, all the way up to one. Okay, so there's a wide variety of spins. We're actually getting astrophysically relevant information, spin distributions out, from the simple alpha disk model. So that's thin disks. Thick disks are a bit more complicated. The ones that I'm going to talk about, I'm not talking about the thick disks on super Eddington flows or on the gamma ray bursts, et cetera, but thick disks like are appropriate in the galactic center. These are typically optically thin, and as a consequence, the luminosity is a globally correlated and non-thermal quantity. That is to say, you can't say the luminosity started from this point and went off to infinity. You have to integrate through an entire region. They're radiatively inefficient, and that means they're geometrically thick. That also means that the electrons and the protons, ions, don't necessarily have the same temperatures. As a consequence, they're strongly dependent upon nonlinear MHD processes, which give you an idea of why people don't like to talk about them as much. They're complicated. And in order to address this, we do have a number of analytical models which all throw in some bias somewhere or some guess for an outflow. We really need to appeal to numerical simulations. Generally, you find that you get power law kinds of dependencies on density and for the density for the magnetic field strength, et cetera. And there are outflows, and you do have this complicated two-temperature flow. And, here's a picture of one such simulation by Jonathan McKinney. So people do these. They can do global simulations and find interesting things. We can take these and make pictures of them. You may have seen pictures of thin disks before. Here's pictures of thick disks, and they all have this kind of crescent morphology. And this crescent morphology is dictated by two things. First, gravitational lensing. You see this empty region in here and in here. That's due to the horizon of the black hole and the lensing of the accretion flow around the black hole. The second is orbital motion. The oncoming side is much brighter than the receding side just because the oncoming side is Doppler boosted and Doppler beamed towards us. And the third is opacity. Strictly speaking, we'd like to look at completely optically thin accretion flows, but that's not the case in the observationally relevant frequencies. But despite the fact that the morphologies are more or less similar, the shapes and the sizes in detail depend upon the spin and the inclination. So here's a pair of different inclinations, different spins, and so you might hope that if you had the capability to image these kinds of things, you could say something. But that means imaging black holes on horizon-resolving scales. But I already told you a moment ago that there's a size constraint on Sagittarius star, on the photosphere of Sagittarius star, that's comparable to the photon orbit. And that size constraint actually involves probing sub-horizon scales. So we are now at a position where using millimeter and sub-millimeter VLBI, we can begin to probe sub-horizon scales in these objects. And so we can do this experiment, and we've done this. And what we find is some limits upon the spin magnitude. Generally, it's lower, not higher, not anything as nice as those measurements from the thin disks. We have some limits on the inclination. These results seem to be relatively insensitive to the details of the thick disk you employ, which is a good thing. And they seem to be consistent with the presence of a clockwise stellar disk in the vicinity of Sagittarius star. These are young, massive stars. It's hard to understand how they would have been formed far away and moved in. So one of the theories for their formation is they were formed by a dense gas disk and formed in situ a million years ago. And there's enough gas in the disk to align the spin with those stars. So the fact that we get a number that's comparable and is consistent with the angular momentum direction of this disk at least gives us a story that holds together. All right, so that's accretion. It's kind of where we, or some interesting topics in accretion, where we are now. Next, let me move on to a discussion of astrophysical jets. So we talked about things falling onto black holes. Now let's talk about things flying out. These are highly collimated. They're ultra-relativistic. We frequently see in AGN these double-lobed radio sources that have just tremendous amounts of energy in the lobes, something like 10 to the 60 ergs in the two lobes. All right, this is, you know, enormous compared to the kind of energies you end up in supernovae. And they're presumably powered by some analog or version of the Blanford-Nayak process. We heard a bit about that from Carlos earlier today. It's just a means of extracting energy using electromagnetic fields. It's kind of an electromagnetic version of a Penrose process. The first thing to realize about jets is that they're generic. We see them in every kind of black hole system we know about. Okay, in X-ray binaries, like SS-433, they have jets with Lorentz factors on the order of 3. In this case, it's corkscrewing around. It's precessing with the binary. So we know in at least one case the spin of the black hole and the orbital momentum of the binary are not aligned. And you can see that in this movie which just played, where the spin or the jet direction shifted by 1/4 of an orbit. We see this in AGN. We showed one example, 3C175. Okay, but there are lots of them. You can go on Google and find as many examples of AGN jets as you'd like. And these ones are all the FR2 jets. They have this very long, thin, highly collimated outflow terminating in these enormous radial lobes. There is also another kind, these FR1 jets, which are a little bit less collimated and immediately start waving around. We don't really know what the distinction is. It might be high spin and low spin. It might be being in a dense environment or being in an undense environment. One of the reasons why I mentioned them is I couldn't help show you a picture of Centaurus A. There's the LISA error box. So we're really talking about enormous structures when we talk about jets. So LISA shouldn't feel too bad about their localization. All right. And they extend for hundreds of kiloparsecs. Like the X-ray binaries, we can make movies of their radio emission on all parsec scales. We can see movement. Now, it takes more than a few days. It takes months to do this. But we can measure the velocities of these, and this is where we get the limits of superluminal motion upon the Lorentz factor of AGN jets. And the third example that's frequently touted is that of gamma ray bursts. And these have the most extreme Lorentz factors of any system known, hundreds to tens of thousands. Unfortunately, that's a circumstantial case. We don't have direct evidence. We don't see jets expanding out from gamma ray bursts. It's worth going over briefly to give you a flavor of how these things work, explaining how we come to these kinds of numbers. We get high Lorentz factors essentially from optical depths and pair production. We know high energy gamma rays are getting out of the emission region because that's what we see. That's the defining feature. And that means that the emission region cannot be completely filled with leptons, electrons and positrons, or otherwise it would be Compton thick. On the other hand, we know that the energy in the photons getting out is quite high. I mean, they're gamma ray bursts. They're not ultraviolet bursts. And we have plenty of MeV and above photons, which in principle could pair produce. And so we require that somehow we limit the amount of pair production that's occurring. Now, the condition that you pair produce is relatively simple. It's just the product of the two photon energies times a geometric factor, which is defined in whatever frame you want, has to be bigger than the rest mass of the electron squared. This is just energy conservation in the center of momentum frame. All right. If the gamma rays are isotropic in our frame, this is clearly satisfied, and we ought to pair produce up the wazoo. But if they're isotropic in a frame that's moving with a large bulk Lorentz factor, in the lab frame, the frame where we know the energies of the photons, they're all moving nearly parallel. How parallel? Well, within an angle of 1 over gamma, and so that angular factor turns into 1 over 2 gamma squared. And that implies that if we make them move fast enough, we can make it so few enough photons satisfy this condition that during the lifetime of the given subpulse within the gamma ray burst, you don't populate the emission region with too many pairs. There's also a length contraction effect. I just mention it because most people fail to. But those two things in combination are what give us this large Lorentz factor. In addition to that, we have to show that they're collimated. And as a theorist, it's nice to appeal to collimation just because of energetics. It's hard to make explosions that are energetic enough to reproduce isotropic energies. Okay? But the real observational proof is the achromatic breaks in the light curves. If we see a relativistically expanding explosion, it's plowing into stuff and slowing down, we only ever see a small part of the surface, the emitting region, the part that's 1 over gamma. And as it slows down, we see an increasingly large part. And so that gives us an increasing flux, but at the same time, as it slows down, less energy is being thermalized and less energy is going into radiation, and so we see a steep decline that's been mitigated by this enlarging patch on the emission region. And for the initial phase of the afterglow, this is days after the burst, this is the story. We see it going down, but less steeply than you might have expected because you see more and more of the explosion region. At some point, we see all of it if it's collimated. And once you see all of it, there's nothing left to see, and the mitigation effect goes away, and you start to track on this much steeper decline. And so the transition between this slow decline and the steep decline, purely geometric effect, it should happen at all frequencies at the same time, is the X-rays. These are our optical UV infrared data points, and it does. And that's where we get typical estimates for the opening angles of gamma ray bursts of 5 to 10 degrees. So this is the circumstantial evidence which gives us these numbers. So how do we make jets? What's the theory behind it? Well, here's a jet simulation. Generically, we see these helical, toroidally dominated magnetic fields. Don't worry about the fact that every now and then they start jiggling all over the place. That's just an artifact of how the magnetic field lines are drawn. These things, because they're toroidally dominated, are marginally unstable or marginally stable, depending on how you want to look at it, to various plasma instabilities. But they are stabilized by the relativistic rotation and relativistic motion. So these do produce stable, if not deformed, structures consistent with the jets we see. And they have this canonical structure. In the middle, there's an MHD disk. Okay, in between the disk and the jet, there's a unbound and bound components to a magnetically dominated wind. What I mean by that is the magnetic pressure dominates the gas pressure. And inside the jet, shown by this blue region, it's force-free. That means the inertia of the particles is irrelevant. We can throw them away. And we can do the kinds of simulations that Carlos did. Now, let me just show this again for a moment. Oops. Okay. In orange, we see densities. Orange and green are densities. The magnetic field lines are these green lines. The blue and magenta are the Lorentz factor. And something I'll come back to in a moment, I just wanted to point out beforehand, is that the Lorentz factor is very high in the jet region, as you'd expect, but it is not uniform. It's conical. You see, you have this nice, bright conical region with high Lorentz factors and a kind of an empty core. Okay. So that's a good simulation. Those are great. They're expensive, and we don't always understand what we're seeing, so we can make cartoon models and maybe gain some insight. Maybe explain some of the results we saw in Carlos's simulations, too. And for these, we're going to assume it's stationary and axis symmetric. So we're going to look at things that aren't changing. We're going to look at things that are cylindrically symmetric. And we're going to assume it's force-free. So remember, that's what we just learned from the simulations. And what that means is that the Lorentz force vanishes everywhere. And this is a purely electromagnetic equation because I can reproduce the charge density and the current density in terms of the electromagnetic fields. All right. So this is a perfectly well-defined set of equations. What I really need now are boundary conditions. And there are a number of ways to set those. I could go specify the electric field everywhere along some slice, or since E dot V vanishes in general in force-free, I could specify a velocity and say that E is V cross V. And here I'm specifying an angular velocity of the field lines. This is the angular velocity of the frame in which the electric field vanishes. And here it peaks near the center and falls off as we get far, far away, and that implies electric fields in the equatorial plane, and then along with various invariants in force-free, that implies what the electric fields are along field lines. But now I have electric fields involved, and I want to satisfy the force-free equation, so I need to have currents. And if I have currents, I end up producing toroidal magnetic fields. But now I have a toroidal magnetic field and a poloidal electric field, and that gives me a pointing flux. And that's my Infernayak. That's pretty much it. You specify the angular velocity of field lines using the dragging of the field lines due to space-time, and then force-free gives you everything else. We might try to do a slightly better job of this by throwing in an accretion disk. In that case, we have an MHD disk pulling things around, not necessarily just the space-time, and that changes our boundary condition. Okay, it changes what the angular velocity of the field lines are, and here they generally peak at the ISCO. Right, so the fastest field lines are moving at the inner edge of the disk. Then it's the same story. We get an electric field everywhere. We define our boundary conditions. We get currents. We get toroidal fields. We get a pointing flux. The important point here is that because the velocity is maximized at the ISCO, the maximum pointing flux is along that special field line that crosses the innermost stable circular orbit, that crosses the inner edge of the disk. All right. So this is what controls that conical shape that we saw in the simulation. Here's a slightly more sophisticated version of exactly these kinds of arguments. It's a force-free jet and cylindrical symmetry, except here it's properly done in a proper relativistic way. And you have the Lorentz factor, shown by these contours in this plot, increasing along this critical field line that crosses the ISCO of the disk. And, of course, you do see this in the simulations. Here's a very simplistic plot of the simulation data. You have the disk down here. You have your wind, like I claimed. The jet is defined by this red line. And the Lorentz factor, things become unbound first along this black line here, and the Lorentz factor increases as you move up. And just to refresh your memory, this is what we saw in the simulation. Okay, so this reproduces a lot of the behaviors, and it also tells us why spin is so important to jet production, at least theoretically. Because rapidly rotating black holes have ISCOs that are in very close to the black hole and have motions that are very high that produce large pointing fluxes. Slowly rotating black holes or non-rotating black holes have ISCOs quite far out, and as a consequence, the pointing fluxes along the field line crossing the inner edge of that disk are very low, and God forbid you should have retrograde disks. So I mentioned horizon-resolving images. It turns out we can do this for M87 as well. This is the kind of image you might get if you were to look at a jet like the cartoon model I showed you before. This golden dot's the ideal resolution that can be achieved from Earth, and you'll note that this is smaller than the size of the horizon, which is shown by this kind of shadow or silhouette. All right. So this kind of observation would immediately begin to tell us where observationally is the black hole in this process. How is it related to the parts of the jets we see? But since we have a cartoon model and we're not constrained by reality, we can start varying all kinds of things. We can ask, well, what if the jet comes from a broader region? What if it's not the black hole, but the disk that's important in jet production? What if the black hole is not rotating? Here we don't see very fast flows, so we get a much more diffuse, a larger body of emission. What happens if they collimate at different rates than come out of the simulations? And even how fast do they accelerate? In all of these pictures, you actually see the counterjet. That's the fluff against which the black hole is silhouetted. The jet is this thing on top. Okay, so if that fluff isn't there, or if it's very dim, that tells us something about the velocity of the counterjet compared to the jet. So that's something about imaging. Now, I wanted to mention something very speculative, fun to talk about. That has to do with rotation measures. And this is a way in which you might learn something important about black holes from observations at parsec scales, which is thousands of gravitational radii away. So first, what is a rotation measure? Rotation measures associated with Faraday rotation, which is a polarization effect. The direction of the polarization rotates around the line of sight as it propagates through a magnetized plasma. The amount of rotation is the wavelength squared times some density-weighted integral of the line-of-sight magnetic field, and we call that density-weighted integral the rotation measure. You actually measure this by determining the polarization direction at a number of different frequencies. You fit lambda squared to it, you pull out the coefficient, that's your rotation measure. So it's really just some information about the line-of-sight magnetic field modulated by the density. And the important thing here is that in jets, we have this nice toroidal structure in the jet for the magnetic field. And that means that when the magnetic field is going away from us, we ought to see rotation measures that are negative. Polarization rotates in one way. And on the side that's coming towards us, we ought to see rotation measures that are positive. It rotates the other way. And so we can try to measure a transverse gradient across AGN jets. And from that, infer something about the structure of the magnetic fields. And you can simulate these. Okay, here's a picture of those rotation measures, the previous. This is a polarization map. That's a real jet. Looks kind of similar. Here's rotation measures. We see nice gradients across the jet, just like I described. And you even see them in practice. Here's 3C273. Along this bar, here's the rotation measure. You see a gradient, and I think everybody now agrees that that's real. There are a number of other jets where you see rotation measure gradients as well, although maybe there's some controversy in some of these cases. Nevertheless, people measure rotation measures, we see gradients. Now, MHD theory of jets tells us that we should see positive gradients as much as negative gradients, because it doesn't matter if it's corkscrewing around one way or if the magnetic field's in exactly the opposite direction. I can reverse the direction of the magnetic field and nothing changes in MHD. But in practice, of the 29 systems that show believable gradients, 22 are in one direction. Now, the DA part of this conference will say that's a 2 sigma effect. So what? You know, half of 29 is 15. The square root of 15 is 4. 2 times 4 is 8, and that's the difference between 22 and 15. 2 sigma. So what? Well, it turns out that contrary to my best inklings, 29 is still small. It's still a small number statistic, and if you do the binomial statistics right, you get that there's only a 0.4% probability of seeing this kind of disparity. So it's more like a 3 sigma effect, which is important, and it starts people thinking, how would you do this? What's special that makes the gradients all seem to go in the same way? And a possible solution has to do with the relationship between the spin of the black hole, or the angular momentum of the disk, and the magnetic field direction near the black hole, near the ISCO, at the inner edge of that accretion disk. So here we have a disk that's rotating around like this, the angular momentum vector is up. It's dragging the field lines, or one field line shown by the red line here. And that means it's going away from us on the left side, towards us on the right side. We see a gradient that looks like this. We're only going to look at the top jet because you're my observers. Now, if we were to turn this around, okay, just turn the whole system around, it looks pretty similar. Away, towards us, same rotation measure gradient. So as long as the poloidal field direction is correlated with the angular momentum of the disk, which should be correlated, as we said before, with the spin of the black hole, then we're able to reproduce this preponderance of one direction. So how do you do that? How do you correlate those quantities? The thing that people have been talking about is this pointing Robertson battery. It feeds off the difference in the electron and the proton masses, and it naturally produces this effect. I don't really want to describe it in any detail. I just want to point out that this effect takes 100,000 years. And I think everybody here has a pretty good feel for the dynamical timescales of black holes, and that's a very long time. So I can't imagine that that's correct. On the other hand, there's another possibility. It's entirely speculative, and that's charge. And when I give talks, normally the first thing I say is that black holes are nice and simple. They're described by 3 parameters, and in practice only 2, because charge is never important. And that is true for gravity. But it is not necessarily true for the dynamics of orbiting stuff. And a charged black hole has a magnetic moment, and so there's an energetic cost to having colloidal magnetic fields in one direction relative to the next. So the question is this magnetic moment important? And the answer is, I don't know. It's a relatively new idea. But we might be seeing evidence for charged black holes, not gravitationally important charges, but astrophysically important charges, charged black holes in the parsec scale rotation measures of quasar or AGN jets. All right, so in the last few minutes, I wanted to address the problem that has been the focus of much of the meeting. It's essentially the two-body problem. We have some big black hole, possibly spinning. We have some little black hole orbiting around. It emits gravitational waves. You can do lots of beautiful physics with this. And for gravitational waves, I think, despite the emphasis on the NR and on perturbation theory in the Kaffer meeting, I think that it's safe to say that for gravitational waves, the problem is essentially a detection problem. It's just really hard to measure gravitational waves. But we have the exact same situation in the electromagnetic universe. Okay, we see blobs of stuff orbiting black holes, presumably. All right, our mass ratios are much better than yours. That's 1 billion to 1 or 10 billion to 1. We don't need to worry about self-force. Certainly don't need to do numerical GR simulations to get it right. There are complications, however. Rarely is there something singly moving around, and we face a validation problem. How do we know that the thing we see orbiting has anything to do with the details of the space-time and isn't just a consequence of some perturbation in a larger hydrodynamic or MHD structure? Now, that problem isn't always there. So here's a movie that Scott Hughes showed on Thursday. This comes from Andrea Ghez's group at UCLA, where they watched very carefully the stellar orbits of stars near the black hole in the center of our galaxy. And just like you weigh the sun using the planets, they weigh the black hole in the center of the galaxy using these orbits. And this is a tremendous feat. Scott mentioned that we know its mass to 10%. I think he undersold that. This is the only black hole in which they actually quote systematic errors in their mass estimates. Because in every other case, the error is so big, you wouldn't believe that they measured anything. We know that it's 4.3 million solar masses, plus or minus 10%, including systematics. This is by far the best measured mass of a black hole in the universe right now. These stars really are test particles, and you only see a few of them. And the reason why you only see a few of them is because we're confusion limited and flux limited in practice. These are all B stars. These are enormous stars. They are the very high end of the mass function of stars near the galactic center. There are many more stars, and there may be stars that pass closer than S15, which comes closest. It comes within about 50 astronomical units of Sagittarius star. However, a new generation of infrared telescopes, the 30-meter telescope, the extra-large telescope, the giant Magellan telescope, which are all on the drawing board and people are furiously securing funding for, promise to make headway on this. We'll be able to see a whole new population of stars, and we'll be able to distinguish them and use them to measure more orbits, more about the gravity of the black hole, tighten this number tremendously, and even see spin precession and gravitational, just the general relativistic precession of the orbits. However, this is all at 1,000 m right now. This is pretty far away. It's not sexy enough. On the other hand, we have these quasi-periodic oscillations. People have talked a lot about these in conferences, the kinds of conferences I go to mostly. They have typical frequencies, 300 hertz, which is comparable to the azimuthal epicyclic frequency for a 10 solar mass black hole. And so people think that maybe these oscillations, which seem to be persistent and pop up at the same frequencies more or less always, have something to do with the orbital motions. They also seem to have some resonant behavior, 3-to-2 ratios, although this has been questioned recently. And as a consequence of these, people try to fit these pulsations with the epicyclic frequencies and resonances between them. So we have the Keplerian frequency, the azimuthal vertical frequency, and the radial frequency. And you just pick two, you play some numerology, you spit out some relation, and you say, aha, I've explained something. People try to do a slightly better job by appealing to disk modes, disco seismology, which has nothing to do with dancing. And unfortunately, it seems that these are not good resonators. So this is still a question, okay? But there's certainly something going on near black holes that's producing periodic signals. Neutron stars have a much more varied set of pulsations. Here's pulsations from type 1 X-ray bursts. This is the nuclear burning of accreted material from the companion star. And we see an evolving, but you know, roughly 300 hertz or so spin period. And this is thought to be associated with the spin of the neutron star itself. On the other hand, we have these giant flare QPOs, which are just enormous, almost certainly some short gamma-ray bursts. Short, hard gamma-ray bursts are actually these. And in this case, we see a whole plethora of pulsation modes. Some of them persist for the entire burst, some of them only for a short time. And despite the nice, apparently periodic structure of the light curve, these clearly are not the spin of the object. It's thought that these are mostly crustal oscillations. And then there's the kilohertz QPOs, which are kind of similar to the QPOs we see in black holes. These are separated generally by something related to the spin. So you measure the spin via the type 1 X-ray bursts, and then you look at the quiescent X-ray emission, measure the QPOs, you get some set of frequencies for the two, you take a difference, and in a number of cases it looks like the difference is the spin of the neutron star, which is kind of nice because you have this good clock sitting there, you have some oscillation period in the disk, and you resonantly excite the one that has another guy right next door. The thing that I always thought was fascinating about these is that there's a number of sources in which the difference is twice the spin period, or twice the spin frequency of the neutron star. Well, in these cases, the neutron star has to go around twice in order to get back to where it was. And so that means that these guys are actually a macroscopic manifestation of spin one half spinners. The thing has to go around twice to get back to where it was. Now, people have various hydrodynamic theories for this. None of them are terribly convincing, but I always thought that was a fascinating thing. Spinners are real. All this structure, the time structure in the accretion flows of black holes, suggests that maybe we ought to be looking for time-various signals in all black holes. And maybe there are other ways we can try to validate what those things are from, what that time variability is from. Since in QPOs, it's not clear we understand this. And one possible way to do that is to look for time variability in iron lines. And so here's a picture of an X-ray observation, Suzuka observation of the relativistically broadened iron line from MCG 63015. This is the quintessential broad iron line source. And I just wanted to point out that this is a time-integrated spectrum. If we were to look at a blob orbiting the black hole, and we were to look at it over here where it's coming towards us, we would see a very narrow iron line perhaps up there. At a slightly later time, when it's now in front of the black hole, it's not moving towards us anymore, so its Doppler shifted down, and it's a bit dimmer due to line of sight projection effects. We see something down here. And then on the other side, it's at even lower energy due to Doppler boosting, and it's a little bit bigger than the face-on case just because of line of sight effects, but smaller than the case when it was coming towards us, the approaching side, due to beaming. And this produces this asymmetric double-peaked line profile, which is well-loved in astronomy. I should point out that 6.4 keV is around here. If this thing were non-relativistic, the center should be at 6.4 keV. This is the energy of this iron fluorescence line that we measure in the laboratory, but it's not. It's shifted down because of gravitational redshift. And when we add together stuff on a lot of orbits, we end up with a bunch of different lines that we have to add together, and this is what reproduces this characteristic shape. And the reason why I mention that is because accretion flows are not expected to be nice and smooth. They're expected to have clumps of materials that are bouncing around. And as a consequence, we expect to see evolution in the spectrum. So this is the spectrum as a function of time. And you see characteristic evolution in the spectrum if you can resolve it in time. And that tells you something about the orbits of the fluorescing material. And so how do you do this experiment? You get an enormous X-ray bucket. You collect as many X-rays as you can. This experiment is called ICSO. That's a bad word around these parts because it competes with LISA for funding. Nevertheless, this is one way to try to get at this astrophysically. There are other ways. We know in Sagittarius Star that it's variable as well. We see that in the infrared and X-ray light curves. We even see something that people might claim are QPOs. The bold among us do. The meek among us simply say, yeah, it bounces a couple times. Maybe it's something. What might cause this? This is a little bit different than just clumps in the material. In something like Sagittarius Star, the picture I have is much more like flares from the sun. We have rapid conversion of magnetic energy through reconnection into non-thermal electrons, which then radiate like the Dickens as they're trapped on the magnetic field lines. except it doesn't quite look like the sun, because inside a star, these electrons are subdominant always, even when you dump lots of energy into them. And you can make the source hundreds of times brighter before you do anything to the structure of the accretion flow. So we really have dense, bright, non-thermal spots. And since they're small, they're also long-lived. So what would observations of a dense non-thermal spot look like, and why would it be useful? Well, remember we talked a little bit about looking at these horizon-resolving images of the accretion flow. Just like the iron line measurements, time-resolved iron line measurements show where the spectrum comes from, here we see where the emission at a given location is coming from, corresponding to where the spot is in its orbit. So we've temporarily separated where the emission that we see in the averaged image comes from. And we can use that information by comparing the primary and secondary images to say something about the spin. And one of the interesting things about these is it's an experiment very similar to an EMRI. Unlike an EMRI, we're only going to see a couple periods ever. The cooling time is relatively short. But we can see many different spots. So where an EMRI event happens once, you've seen that black hole, now you move on to see another one. Here, there is a spot every day or so. And you can do this over and over and over again, and presumably the spots don't happen at the same radii. And when they happen at different radii, they are located at different positions in the image plane, and you can tell the difference. And so the name of the game would be to see different spots, probe different regions, and make different measurements, independent measurements of the spin parameter of the black hole, and with those do the same thing that you do with EMRIs, try to test the no-hair theorems that occur after you've convinced yourself you've gotten a handle on the orbital dynamics of these things sufficiently well. Also, like gravitational waves, we could produce nice oscillating functions of observables. This is a nice, robust observable in radio astronomy called the closure phase. It's made by combining telescopes in a triangle. Here's a particular spot model. For things that we can do today, we kind of get these black dots. And the red line is the predicted variation in this as a consequence of the orbit of the spot going around the black hole. In a few years, as ALMA is commissioned, we can do this. So this is our LIGO. This is our LISA. And we really will be able to start distinguishing these for a wide number, a wide variety of spot distances, inclinations, orbital models, and in fact, the details of the spots themselves. So this really is happening now. All right, so just to summarize, since my time is just about up, where are we today when it comes to the astrophysics of objects? Already we know quite a bit about fundamental gravity just from these astrophysical observations, just from the astrophysical hair that's on these compact objects. And we're already measuring the spin, albeit for a much smaller sample than is promised by gravitational wave observations. And we've only scratched the surface in exploiting the phenomenology. There's a tremendous amount that we still don't understand about it, and all of this has interesting signatures of something. You just have to figure out what. Okay, so there's a lot of handles to use to try and understand what's going on with the compact object, not just with the accretion flow, not just with the hair itself. And there are new capabilities on the horizon, like large telescopes, millimeter VLBI telescopes, X-ray telescopes, et cetera, that are going to make this even better in the future. And finally, we talked about the difference between clean experiments and dirty experiments. Well, messy astrophysics makes for happy astrophysicists. It gives us something to do, something to play with, and something to understand. Thank you very much.
All right, other questions? All right, over there.
So yesterday in the bistro, people were placing bets on who was going to be winning a particular game. So I'm trying to find out some inside information. So when do you think BLBI with this millimeter detectors will be able to probe the, say, the geometry of a horizon or around the black hole? I'm just trying to think if I ever get someone who wants to bet me who will get there first, LIGO or you guys. Just trying to see if I can have some better thing to say.
Right. So remember I said the problem is validation. It's not clear that these oscillations we see in light curves have anything to do with orbital dynamics. And the first thing we have to do is verify that there's changing structure in the source, and that's what's causing the various oscillations. That's going to happen next year or so. That triangle I just showed, we're going to have things that look like that next year. And Alma has dishes coming online or being commissioned at a rapid pace now. And so adding a bunch of Alma dishes together in the next couple of years. Getting enough measurements to understand the spin is going to depend upon what we see. And this is all the undiscovered country, really, and if we assume everything's moving on Keplerian orbits, then that's relatively straightforward. But if it's drastically sub-Keplerian, and for thick accretion flows, that's not crazy, then it might be a little bit more difficult. And then we'd actually have to be able to do this for many, many spots. And that becomes a political problem because you just need to get enough telescopes that people begged and borrowed and stole to build to give you their telescope time to do VLBI, which is notoriously time-consuming. So that, I think, we're talking about 5 to 10 years. We have a white paper up. There was a white paper we sent in last year to ASTRO 2010 on the Event Horizon Telescope. So we're ahead of the game. We have out a cool name. And you can go look that up on ASTRO-PH and look at the detailed timeline. And that, I think, was a reasonably conservative timeline. And it's in the next 10 years or so we should be seeing these things. We will never do as good a job as LISA will in constraining curve. But we will be able to constrain the relationship between the black hole and the electromagnetic emission, which LISA can't do. So I hope that answered roughly your question.
So are there cases in which you can, So are there cases in which you can measure I'm talking about galactic jets, are cases in which you can see the jets as well as the larger scale structure of the galaxy, or is the AGN always too luminous to observe features like the galactic disk? So I'm wondering if you see a correlation between the direction of the jets the larger scale structure.
You want to know if there's any relationship between the jet and the galaxy?
Yep.
No.
Because the AGN is always too luminous.
Yeah. Spin of a black hole could be whatever direction it wants to be in. And presumably that has something to do with the jet. I mean, it was mentioned before that we think it's critical, but I should emphasize that that's a theoretical statement. It's a bias. We don't actually know how the spin is related to the jet observationally yet. But they do come off in directions which have nothing to do with the galactic plane, et cetera.
Okay, thank you.
The race is on.
Can you go back to the slide you had about 6 or 7 slides in that had the table of spins for black holes?
That's up too far. Here we go. That?
Yeah, that's it. So these black hole spins, are these supermassive black holes in galactic
jets?
These
are all X-ray binaries.
These are all X-ray binaries, okay. Because one of the things that is something that I thought I knew, but maybe don't, is people argue that, you know, black holes will be spun up to very high spins, and so we should be worrying a lot about very high spins, but it seems here there's a huge range of spins from...
So the way you get to very high spins is accretion. And so the question of whether or not you expect to have very high spins in these cases is really a question about the accretion history of these objects. None of these objects are old enough to have had their spins spun up or aligned by accretion. That is an important point, because remember I said the inclination, we assume the inclination of the disk is the same as the inclination of the binary. That is true if the binary has spun up the black hole. But we know that's not the case here, not just because the numbers are all over the place, you just make estimates of how much mass transfer there's been, and frequently it's a tiny fraction of the solar mass. And therefore, you know, that really does make that inclination a little uncertain. And that's the primary systematic uncertainty. All of the random uncertainties are included in these ranges, but the systematic uncertainty, which they don't include in these ranges, is that inclination.
Thanks.
Actually, speaking of that alignment, Is the Bardeen-Peterson effect enough to help you realign? So I guess there are two questions about that. One is whether, and maybe this is actually more a question for the supernova experts like Christian, but it's a question of whether how much of a kick do you expect to the spin axis at the supernova? In other words, if before the supernova you already had some mass transfer going on and you already had alignment, do you expect to things to be misaligned during the supernova? And the second question is, after the supernova happens, there may not be enough mass transfer directly to realign things, but will the Bardeen-Peterson effect or torque in the disk help you to achieve realignment on shorter timescales and actual mass transfer?
So Bardeen-Peterson is good. Natarajan and Pringle is better, and in that case, it's Bardeen-Peterson plus viscosity, and you have viscous waves transported out into the disk. It gives you a larger moment, more easy to rotate the spin. In all of these cases, you roughly need something like the mass of the black hole in the affected region. So you don't have to accrete as much, but you need something like the mass of the black hole in the region that's trying to align the spin. And in this case, the accretion history of these objects is much, much less than that. So they've looked at these situations, done the back of the envelope calculation. It's clear that these spins do represent the formation spins and have not evolved significantly since then. Now, do you expect the spin to be wildly misaligned after the formation of the black hole? Well, this is a good question for people like you and Vicky and others who do population synthesis calculations, and it is absolutely unclear. Some people do simulations of formation of these objects and occasionally say that it looks like within a few tens of degrees you're more or less okay, but I think that's really an unanswered question. So I don't know if it should be aligned or not.
Wait, are there more questions? Last chance. All right, let's thank Avery again.